Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 39,185,605. That's how many people live in California. And for the second straight year, the number of people who call California home has dropped. The latest numbers released by the Department of Finance show California lost more than 100,000 people in 2021. We're still the most populous state in the country, but still, we're now at a population not seen since 2016. So is this a good thing? I mean, there's less people on the roads, less competition at colleges, universities, buying a home. Maybe, though, it is not the best thing. So we're going to spend some time learning and understanding how this decline impacts all of us. Eric McGee is a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank, and joins us to break down what the numbers mean. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. So big picture, why should we care about the number of people living in California?
Well, I think the most immediate reason is that it tells us something about the experience of being a Californian, what it's like to live in California. When people are leaving the state, it suggests that there are a growing number of people who don't find living in California to be accessible, to be possible in many cases. And we should be worried about what that says about the state as well.
So what is the broader impact when the population declines, given that this is the second year in a row?
Well, it's going to mean it's sort of in the near term, we're looking at things like declining school enrollment. So that's going to create a shuffle there, potentially declining tax revenue, although a lot of the people who are leaving the state are poorer people who don't pay as much in taxes. And the wealthier people who do pay taxes actually tend on balance to be coming to the state. It also says something about sort of the future trajectory of our economy. And the sort of the potential growth and possibility for the state. So there's a lot of ways in which it can matter. I think the main reason that we should be thinking about this and should be concerned about it is because it does potentially say something about the livability of the state and the quality of life in general.
Yeah, and those are conversations that so many people are having and have been having, especially in recent years. What was interesting is that 34 out of California's 58 counties actually saw a decline in population. We're talking about the why and unpacking that. But which area saw the biggest decline?
Well, it was pretty much kind of across the board. The areas along the coast, the major metros along the coast generally saw bigger declines than some other areas. There were some pockets, you know, in some cases you saw actual increases in areas that had smaller counties that had universities, because a lot of students are now coming back to be on campus in person. And so that's moved those counties into the plus column. But a lot of the big coastal counties are seeing population losses, and that's driven by a lot of cost of living concerns is the most likely reason.
Yeah. And when talking about kind of that migration from large metropolitan urban areas that's been happening for the past couple years, I mean, it's not only out of state, but also throughout California. Were there actually any counties that saw growth in population?
Yeah. So the ones I just mentioned, this sort of like Yolo County, I believe Santa Barbara County may have seen an increase. So these counties, smaller counties that have universities, but also like in the Inland Empire, east of Los Angeles, we saw some growth. The explanation for that is that those are areas that are where it's cheaper to live, and they're adjacent to areas with a lot of jobs where it's more expensive to live. And so it's just people are moving out to the cheaper areas in order to be able to access the more expensive areas where the jobs are, but living in an area where they can afford.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm from Southern California. I'm well aware of that commute of going into the city and living outside
exactly.
of the city where it is more affordable. That happens in Northern California and the Bay Area as well. So there's a lot of factors at play here. A lot has happened in the last year. So let's just go through some of them, like line item, just careful. What impact did COVID deaths actually have on the population decline?
Well, yeah, so there's what demographers call natural increase in population, which is births minus deaths, right? And there's a longer term trend where births are declining in California and across the country, actually. But then, as you say, the deaths part of the equation has been tragically a much bigger impact in the last couple of years from COVID. So there's no doubt that our the number of deaths we've seen in the state has been way above what you would typically see for the same period of time. And that has pulled down the overall population growth that we could expect from natural increase. Some of that, hopefully, of course, some of that will be coming back. We won't have the same number of deaths moving forward. That's what everybody is praying for. But as we see that, we may see some kind of stabilization on that part of the equation. But there is no doubt that there's a longer term pattern here of the population is aging. We are not having as many children as we used to. That's not just a California thing. It's a whole country thing. But nonetheless, it's a pattern that is kind of putting a drag on population growth on that side of the ledger.
Okay, right. So pandemic or COVID deaths aside, people who've passed away because of COVID, this silver wave that we're kind of talking about, baby boomers are passing away at a rate that is higher than births that are actually happening.
Yeah, it's been a long time in coming, where the because the births are slowing down, and the population is aging. Again, that's not just a California thing, but it is a little bit sharper in California than in many other states. So it used to be that that part, you know, many decades ago, that was actually a plus for California. We had a lot of children, and we were, especially the children of immigrants, added a lot to the birth side of the ledger. But that has been fading a lot. Immigrants, the children of immigrants, that number has been declining. It used to be that Latinos had more children than average. That those numbers have come down a lot. So we're seeing on that sort of natural increase part of it, we're seeing a lot less growth than we used to. Hmm.
And I would imagine there's been migrations to other states. Do we know which states are taking kind of more Californians?
Yeah, I mean, they tend to be states that are nearby. So states like Oregon, Washington, Arizona, Nevada, but also Texas is a big destination for a lot of Californians. And certainly, so we over the last, you know, maybe 30 years or so, we have typically had more people moving from California to other states than have had people from other states moving to California. That's actually a common thing for California. We've been net negative on that in that sense, that domestic migration sense. But that has accelerated a lot over the last few years. It actually predates the pandemic, goes back to maybe 2015, 2016. We've seen a real downturn in that sort of net outflow of people to other states. But yeah, in terms of where they go, they go, again, places where housing tends to be cheaper. So, you know, Arizona, Oregon, Texas.
I'm curious, given that California is a state of immigrants, is it happening in the opposite direction? Are people actually leaving California and going to other countries? Is there any international?
That doesn't happen. Okay. Yeah, that doesn't happen too much. What has changed, actually, is it used to be, you know, we had all these people moving from California to other states, but that was sort of backfilled by a lot of immigration from overseas. So a lot of people coming into the country to California. Obviously, California thinks of itself as a state of immigrants, and we are, right? But that part has slowed down quite a bit as well, both because of changes in the economy, but also changes in policy under the Trump administration that have in many cases not been reversed by Biden. And the pandemic itself also has an impact here, right? It really shut off immigration, a lot fewer people moving around during the pandemic. So that might change again, but that's definitely where we are now. And so that out migration to other states isn't being backed up by more immigration from overseas.
All of this kind of hits home to cost of living. I mean, when you have home prices the way they are these days, which is unaffordable for the vast majority of people, the cost of education, childcare, which competes with a mortgage, taxes, gas prices. I mean, inflation is everywhere, but arguably we feel it more in California. How much can we attribute to that?
Well, it's hard to say exactly why everybody people move for all kinds of different reasons, but the main thing that people say when they've moved in census surveys is they say that housing is the most common thing, and just if we look at who is moving, the people leaving California are lower income, and that's consistent with the idea that they're having a hard time affording living in California. It's not as consistent with the idea that taxes are too high, because California's taxes are quite progressive. So wealthier people pay a lot more in taxes than poor people do. And yet we have typically a net inflow of wealthy people. So at the higher end income scale, ends of the scale, we have more people coming in than moving out in a typical year. And that's consistent with the idea that they can afford to live in California. It's also generally, I think, consistent with the idea that California is still in many ways an attractive place to live, but some people just can't afford to do it anymore.
Yeah. I mean, given that people who are, you know, lower income or despite regardless of their education level, they're still contributing to the economy and they're part of it. So what are the long term consequences with this?
Yeah, I mean, these are the people who provide many of the essential services that make the state run. So we can imagine kind of in the near term that those services are going to become more expensive as we don't have the people available to supply them. It also just means that for many people, you know, again, most people aren't moving out of state. What they're doing is they're moving to cheaper parts of the state. So most migration happens in a nearer vicinity kind of way. So they move to the next county over or what have you, right? That just means that life is going to be harder for those folks, right? They have to commute farther to get to their jobs. There's going to be more inequality because they can't afford the houses that the wealthier people can afford. And so it just means that more of the kind of California dream is slipping away from a lot of people. And that's definitely something that we should be concerned about and be addressing in terms of policy changes.
Did any of this surprise you?
Well, I would say that this change to being a state that's losing population, that is surprising. It's something that is totally new for California. It's a sea change in terms of California's history to have an actual population decline. This particular report is consistent with the one that we saw the previous year, so it's not as startling in that sense. But the population loss we saw was a little bit smaller than the previous year. So we're maybe seeing things turn around a little bit. But this idea that we're in a new normal of slow population growth at a minimum and possibly even population loss, that's it's really kind of a startling change for California and for people who follow California demography 100%.
Are there any benefits to a decline in population?
Well, I mean, it means less pressure on the resources that we have. It means fewer people on the road, so maybe less traffic. But I think, by and large, it's more concerning in terms of sending a signal about the quality of life in the state and the opportunities that it provides for people.
When we talk about population, especially lately, we're in an election year. I mean, it gets political. Those who are critical of state and local governments would make the argument like, see, everyone is fleeing California. But is that accurate, or is that just a simplistic explanation of what's happening?
Well, there's no doubt that we are not producing enough housing to house the people who want to live here. And that is at least partly a policy decision. California is worse at providing housing than just about every other state in the country. So it's something that we're doing a particularly bad job of. And so I know that there are a lot of people who are very concerned about this issue, and there's a lot of activity in terms of trying to change policy to encourage more housing. And I think we'll see more of that moving forward. It's always, of course, as I said earlier, people move for all kinds of different reasons. So there are almost certainly some people who are moving because they feel the taxes are too high. They feel that there's too much regulation in the state. So I'm sure that some of that is going on. But in kind of the big picture sense, the broad patterns, I think most people don't make a decision as significant as moving to another state based on sort of their policy views. It's going to be more about their, you know, is there a job? Can I afford to live here versus somewhere else? These kinds of just basic bread and butter issues. And I think it's concerning enough that there are a lot of Californians who feel like on those basic bread and butter issues, they can't make ends meet. They can't make it make sense anymore to be in California. I think that's something we should continue to be concerned about.
Yeah. And that's entirely understandable. Before we let you go, Eric, what do you see in the future? Do you think California, or what needs to happen for California to still be a place where population growth becomes the norm again?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's part of it is going to be about making it easy to have a family, to raise children. As you mentioned earlier, that has its own challenges in terms of the cost of childcare and so forth. So I think trying to find family-friendly policies that encourage, make it easier for people to have more children, that's going to help with the births minus deaths part of the equation. But then just trying to find a way to increase the amount of housing that's available, I think is going to really help a lot. That's something that we can't turn around overnight, but we can, I think, ultimately turn around to find a way to build the housing that is going to increase capacity and make it a place where people can find a home again.
Eric McGee is a senior fellow at PPIC. Thanks for spending time with us.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. In the 1 month since a mass shooting killed 6 people and injured 12 others in downtown Sacramento, violence has continued. At least one homicide has happened every week since then within city limits, all but one involving gunfire, which doesn't include a suspect opening fire at a Sacramento police vehicle. That translates to an additional 6 people that have died by homicide. The mass shooting may be the most recently publicized, the second this year in Sacramento County, just weeks apart, but is part of a rising trend in violence. This year is outpacing last year in murders within the city of Sacramento, and 2021 already surpassed 2020. There have been passionate discussions about solutions, investment, and root causes. At the front of these conversations is Mervyn Brookings, the founder of Brother to Brother, a community organization that focuses on gang prevention and intervention through mentoring youth in Sacramento. Good morning, Mervyn. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I want to start back to the beginning. Why did you create Brother to Brother? What did you see that was happening in Sacramento that was missing and that you wanted to fill that gap?
Well, for two reasons. One, there were a lot of young men and a lot of young women in the community of Del Paso Heights, which I'm from, that were, I believe, misguided. And be it they were in an environment where they were seeing and experiencing things that weren't good for them, as well as just having absentee fathers and absentee mothers and being misguided through the lack of guidance. So I wanted to help address that, as well as help young men and young women who's coming home from incarceration, help them turn their lives around, be a model of an example of how they can do it. So it's twofold.
Yeah, and having lived experience is also foundational to your organization. Who are the mentors at Brother to Brother?
Well, we have a wide group of mentors. We have some educators, some attorneys, but primarily Brother to Brother is made up of individuals who at one time or another were on the other side of the law. Former gang members, former robbers, just about any variety of life on the other side of the law that you can imagine. And all these young men have been through it, been there, done that, turned their lives around. And now Brother to Brother gives them a platform to give back to the community that they used to take from.
Yeah. I mean, you've said that, you know, by having mentors who have that lived experience, who are former gang members who have served time or both, that it offers a shortcut to getting through to youth. And last time you joined us was 6 months ago. And I remember you sharing some experiences. You tell us that, you know, you physically intervene successfully during disputes. You know, when moments get heated like that, how do you and other mentors break through?
Well, you hit it right on the head where the shortcut to building relationships. When you have lived experiences with someone in common, it's a shortcut to trust. And once you develop that relationship of trust, you're in a position to help guide and mentor. So we've been able to expedite that relationship building by matching people who've been through the very same things that these young men and young women are going through. And in those moments, when those moments of heated and emotion are at their highest, you want to be able to connect with someone or talk to someone that you know and someone you're familiar with, someone you trust. So that relationship building gives us access to the people that we're trying to reach. And the trust provides the foundation for us to be able to guide them.
Yeah. And it's so important. And unfortunately, you know, we're experiencing a really hard and tragic trend in violence. I mean, when you joined us 6 months ago, it was with former Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn. And we were talking about the rise in violence. And unfortunately, that's continuing to increase. And here we are again. What conversations have you been having?
Well, it's been a variety. You know, unfortunately, we had the mass shooting a month ago today, I believe.
Yeah.
And that was extremely tragic. I think we're just experiencing the post effects of COVID, of the lockdown. When I talk to people, it's like America was on lockdown for the past 2 years. And now we're coming out of it and we're experiencing the psychological, emotional impact of it, not just to those. It's like being in prison, being locked up for a while, and then all of a sudden you're let out. You go through all these ranges of emotions and you deal with the psychological impact of what you just went through. And a lot of us were just not prepared. We didn't realize the impact that it was actually having on us. And I think that's what we're seeing a lot, because not only are we experiencing the uptick in murders, but if you talk to the school districts, there's an uptick in fights and conflicts. And I don't think that's just by coincidence.
Yeah, no, of course not. And when it comes to what happened a month ago, that shooting, the mass shooting in downtown, I mean, police have said, you know, in the weeks since, that they believe that it was gang related. I mean, given that you are a gang intervention expert really embedded within Sacramento, did you notice or were you hearing anything leading up to that night?
No, that wasn't. I don't know how we could have prevented that night, other than if we had been able to reach those young men and had them in a program prior to, and just having one of them having the courage to step up and pull back could have prevented it. But the police, law enforcement said that it was gang related, and I believe that was simply because the individuals involved were gang members. But I don't necessarily believe that it was motivated by gang life. In other words, there were underlying issues between a couple of those guys involved that I think culminated in that night. But I don't think gangs were the motivation for what happened.
Yeah, that brings me to a conversation more broadly and even a debate that's taking place, you know, since police had linked this specific shooting to gang violence. I mean, do you think that, you know, the sense for some it has kind of diminished what happened, which is kind of diminishes the loss of life that six people died and 12 people were injured?
Definitely. That was such a shock to the conscience of Sacramento, because we've never had anything like that. And especially in an area like downtown where it occurred at, you know, sometimes people that are not touched by violence on a regular basis think that they're immune to it. It doesn't happen over here. Well, I think that showed them it could happen anywhere. And everybody was searching for answers. Everybody was searching to make it make sense. And when you attach gang related to it, then it's easier for that person to say, oh, okay, that's what it was. And you give it a reason, you give it an excuse, and now you're going back to your way of life because we don't have that over here. So that's what that was about. I think it was more about explaining it. But I do believe when you attach gang violence to it, it does minimize the loss of life because that's explainable. Well, that's what happens. You know, and I just don't believe that to be the case.
Yeah, I want to get back to, you know, talking about what's happening at schools and how it's connected to when people are young adults, because the three men that Sacramento police believe were among the shooters are 26 and 27 years old. Two are in custody. One is currently, I believe, still at large. You know, your organization, Brother to Brother, is rooted in prevention, providing alternatives, you know, mentoring youth. Is there an age range when youth are more susceptible?
Honestly, I don't know, because it's so prevalent, and you would think that young men in their late 20s, 30s, and 40s would be beyond gang life, and they're not. The sad truth, they're just not. So you may have the younger individuals that are more active, but they're being fed by the older individuals who may not be active but still promote that lifestyle. And we do it in so many different ways without understanding its impact. You know, for an example, if you watch the Super Bowl and the halftime show, beautiful. I mean, those guys, they put on a beautiful show, very talented individuals. But let's understand, Snoop Dogg is a gang member. He's always, always promoted Crips and gangs. And then when we give them a platform, like the Super Bowl, where you're reaching millions of individuals and you're glorifying that lifestyle, you have young kids who can't differentiate between Snoop the star and Snoop the gang member, because the clothes he wore were gang outfits. And then the dancers you had out there were doing gang dances. So you have the young impressionable kid looking up to that, and they watching their parents glorify it. That's what draws kids into this lifestyle. But what we don't see at the end of that are these shootings. When they get into it, they grow into it. They don't live the Snoop's part of it. They live the day-to-day street part of it. And so we glorify gang banging in this lifestyle so many different ways. And then we start seeing the consequences 10, 20 years from now. I personally, as much as I love the halftime show and respect all of those artists, I personally believe that halftime show will cost us lives down the line. It will attract young men, young women into that life. But when you pick up one end of the stick, the other end comes with it.
Yeah. And you're talking to youth, to children and teenagers, you know, throughout Sacramento. What are they telling you? What conversations are you having, even with their families?
The first thing they'll say was, I got to protect myself. That's why there's such a proliferation of guns that are being taken off the street. I got to protect myself. And it's hard to counter that where in neighborhoods, you have a lot of violence going on. So it's hard to say, hey, you don't need to carry that gun when they know guys that don't like them are carrying guns. And if you're not around them long enough to have that impact, then the moment we leave them, then they're exposed to an entirely different life, which we're talking against. And it's difficult. It is really difficult for them to make those decisions because they don't have that wraparound support. If we're not there and they go home and dad's a gang member and mom's a former gang member. So all their friends are former gang members or gang members. And that's what they're being fed. So it's a difficult conversation to have, but you know, in the effort, you can reach some. You definitely can reach some. We've done it.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with Mervyn Brookins, the founder of Brother to Brother. It's a community organization that focuses on gang prevention and intervention through mentoring at-risk youth. Okay, Mervyn, let's get to progress and solutions, because you have gotten through to youth, to teens and young adults. You know, what are the ingredients to make that a success?
I think the first ingredient is collaboration. Organizations throughout the city of Sacramento and different neighborhoods have to work together, because you can't fix one neighborhood without fixing the other neighborhood. So we need to work together. We call it our Safe Sacramento Coalition, and it involves an organization called Growing Oak Park, which is based in Oak Park, Hope, which is based in Oak Park, Just Us, which is based in the South. There's like six or seven of us that we agree, we work with each other. We bring young men together from our respective neighborhoods to meet and have conversations and get to know each other in a manner other than the gang banging. So it's just to continue to build on those things that we know are successful. When we have an opportunity and the resources to do so, we take them away from Sacramento. We try to get them to experience as many new things in life as possible. A lot of these young men, young women, they don't have any experiences other than what's in their immediate neighborhood. So when you try to get them to make decisions, they have a very limited amount of information from which to draw from. They haven't been in an environment where violence isn't normal. They've never seen that. So we try to get them in those different environments and support them as much as we can to help turn it around. But I think the key is, one, we need long-term commitment from the city, and two, we need to continue to build on the successes that we've had so far.
And you created that coalition, the Save Sacramento Coalition, a few years ago, and so you're working with other community organizations. You know, we've been having a lot of conversations, especially in the past, you know, month or so, about investment. The city's been talking about that. I mean, are you? And you're saying that you don't have sustainable funding. I mean, what kind of investment are you and overall your coalition getting?
Well, I believe that the city has made an investment. A few years ago, when we were having a lot of issues at Art and Fair Mall and different areas, the city came out, met with community members, and they created a plan together to provide alternative places to go and the intervention piece. And that was the pop-ups that you may hear about in different neighborhoods. The city has fully funded that, and it's an excellent program. So young men and young women have, on any given Friday or Saturday night, there's a dozen or so or more organizations having events for them to come to. That's one component. Then the city has invested in prevention and intervention through several groups like myself and others. So the investment is there. What's needed is the long-term commitment. So every year we're not back at the drawing board wondering if we're going to have funding. That's half the battle of keeping people involved in this work. If they don't know whether they're going to be working the next month or so, they'll go and find other ways to take care of themselves. So I think it's we have a lot of areas that we can improve. See, the community-based organizations as well as the city. And I think we're working on that now more so in light of what happened.
Right. I mean, that really kind of like stops you from creating a momentum when you don't have ongoing funding.
Yes. But here's what's key. And here's, you know, it's hard to celebrate something that doesn't happen. So sometimes it's hard to see. You don't hear about the success, because our success is when nothing happens. Mm-hmm. But what's noticeable and with the work that we're doing, we haven't had a single retaliation gunshot on the biggest shooting in Sacramento's history. Not one. And that is directly the result of the work that some of us are doing, working with these individuals in these gangs. Not one gunshot. Not one gunshot in retaliation. And that's a huge success. But we don't speak of it in those terms because nothing happened.
Yeah. That's so profound, especially when, you know, we're talking about a rise in violence, but it follows a short period of meaningful progress before the pandemic. In 2018 and 2019, there were zero youth deaths from gun violence in the city of Sacramento. And you and other organizations were instrumental in that. And when you talk about those pop-ups, I mean, that's like going ice skating, going to the movies, going to the bowling alley, or, you know, barbecues at the park and things of that nature. How do we get back to that number in 2018 and 2019?
We continue to do what we're doing. We continue to focus on solutions and not get caught up in the politics of it, but just focus on solutions. When you talk about the number of no youth deaths in 2 years, that was the result of 5 to 6 years of work by organizations like Neighborhood Wellness, Jackie Rose Foundation, City of Refuge, Impact. There are so many organizations out there doing really good work that you never hear of because they're just doing the work. And over the years, I mean, they're growing young men and young women and collaborating with other organizations. And that's what led to those 2 years. Then we go on lockdown and we lose all of that momentum. And so now we're coming out, we got to figure out a way to get back to that, because coming out of lockdown, now everybody's competing for the same dollars. So where at one point you were allies, now you're competitors to get the same dollar. So we just got to build on the successes of what we know works. And we know mentoring works. We know wraparound services works. We know alternative places to go works. We got to continue to build on those things and not politicize it. But and when I say politicize it, I mean doing things just so you can come out and have an interview and look good, checking a box.
Yeah.
Let's get back to the work and I think we'll be fine.
We're talking about significant challenges. I mean, disinvestment, trauma, sustainable funding shortages. I mean, even I think collectively a sense of hopelessness. You know, what keeps you pushing forward?
Well, the sense of hopelessness we deal with by modeling our message. That's where the similar life experiences come from. If I can do it, you can do it. And not in just a cliche, but I'm here with you to walk you through it. The income and the sustainable resources, that's where we need the support from the city. You know. But you touched on something that is really key in this fight, is that intergenerational trauma. Mm-hmm. We have an organization out in North Sacramento, Neighborhood Wellness, and that's all they focus on. And I mean, they have some very intense healing sessions that are inclusive of, you have the young men that are carrying the guns, you have the young women that are going through things, you have law enforcement there. I mean, you know, they bring together everybody to help each other heal. And they're building so many relationships and bridging so many bridges out there that it's having a remarkable impact in our community.
Well, thank you for all the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mervyn Brookings is the founder of Brother to Brother, a community organization that focuses on gang prevention and intervention through mentoring at-risk youth in Sacramento. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Loss and grief are part of our lives, but the past 2 years, we've been confronted with death in various forms in an extraordinary way, from the loss of loved ones, including pets, to connecting with others, the death of relationships or careers, even more broadly, the environment, mourning losses from wildfires to war, overall violence, even perhaps a sense of overall safety and security. I mean, those layers are really deep, and some aren't all doom and gloom, but have actually opened up brighter and bigger chapters. But our next guest dove into all of that discomfort, those growing pains, asking how do we reckon with our losses and finding some humor even along the way. Suzanne Roberts is a writer and professor based in South Lake Tahoe, joining us about her recent book, Animal Bodies, on death, desire, and other difficulties. Suzanne, happy to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
I want to start with the cover of the book, actually. It's a woman's face that's obscured in a kind of collage-like fashion with foliage. You have portions of leaves, roses, butterflies, and half of the face is blank without features. The woman is muted in black and white. The foliage is in color. Where did you find the inspiration for the cover of the book?
Well, I have nothing to do with finding the cover. The press found the cover, and I just love it. I think it's a beautiful cover, and I think it beautifully conveys what's inside as well. It's from a collage artist called Rocio Montaña. You can find her on Instagram. She's from Spain. And I love this cover so much because I think it really sort of shows the contents of the book, the themes of the book, which are about our own animal natures and how we navigate this planet in these animal bodies.
Yeah, and we're all interconnected. What inspired you to title the book Animal Bodies?
Well, you know, it's a collection of essays about the things that we're taught not to talk about in polite company, about the things that our animal bodies, that our animal natures sort of do without our control or with very little control. Our desires, our hungers, our grief. And so I really wanted to convey this sort of idea that we deny or hide or think only with shame about our most natural hungers, our most natural desires. And I think that this cover does it, and the title as well.
The last time you joined us actually was almost a year ago. It was last May, and we discussed your then new book, Bad Tourist, and you took us across 4 continents, 15 countries, showing us what not to do when traveling. And your book before then was Almost Somewhere, which is also about travel. Animal Bodies is a departure from all of that. What compelled you to go in this direction?
Well, you know, I don't know that it's so much a departure as a deepening. So while Almost Somewhere was about outdoor travel and Bad Tourist was about international travel, both of those books also explored female friendships, they explored identity, they explored body issues and what it sort of means to be a woman in the world, you know, dealing with the male gaze, all those things. And Animal Bodies deepens those conversations. You know, I've suffered a lot of loss the last 5 years. I lost both my parents. Well, I lost my father earlier, but in the last 5 years, I've lost my mom, both my in-laws, a very dear friend, my favorite dog. And so this sort of idea of losing things is also a forefront in my life, and it's one of the things I've just been wanting to write about. And so my earlier themes of travel and adventure also play a role in this book. I mean, there are 10 countries in Animal Bodies. It's not marketed as a travel book per se, but it does traverse external landscapes mm-hmm. as well as internal landscapes.
And you do share those losses in the book. And, you know, these are all like at once they can be intimate. They're very personal and individual, but it's also universal. Did writing about your loved ones and losing them change how you remember your understanding of grief and loss?
Yeah, I think so. I think the reason I write is to kind of figure things out, to figure out why I've done the things I've done, to figure out how I operate in the world. And thinking about all of these losses has really made me think about how I want to live, right? Because, you know, I really explore the sort of opposition of death and desire, right? You know, we often, you know, when someone close to us dies, we often want to go and have a lot of sex. And that's one of the things that's a taboo topic that people don't want to talk about, but it's to prove our own aliveness. And so I really dove in trying to understand how I reacted to these losses and how these losses are collective. You know, when I write about loss, I'm hoping that the reader will think of their own losses and also figure out ways in which to live with these losses.
Yeah. You also found humor, and it's woven throughout the book. Has humor always been with you, a part of your life, especially when coping and taking an honest look at loss and even desire?
Yeah. I grew up with a very funny mother. She's from Northern England, and she has that sort of dark British humor. And so we have always looked at the hardest parts of life through a lens of humor. So that's helped. You know, I incorporated humor into my two earlier books. And, but I also think, you know, I do think about humor, using humor as craft, but I also think that the hardest things in our life are inherently funny, right? So not just because we need the humor as sort of a escape valve, if you will, but I think that humor is derived from surprise, from incongruities. And there's nothing more surprising than death. Even when we know it's coming, even when somebody's been sick for a long time, I think that the moment they die is a huge surprise. It's like, where did they go? And I think that the best way for me in my life to have been able to deal with the hardest things is through the lens of humor.
Yeah, I can relate to that. When my abuela passed away a year and a half ago, you know, we find the humor in that she was a hoarder. And so uprooting the entire house and finding where she hid all the jewelry and things that are valuable, we as a family find a lot of humor in that, even though it's a lot of work, because it's a sign of her character and who she was, and kind of brings her back to life in a sense. You know, at the beginning of the book, I really like that your author's note says that it's sourced from your own fallible memory, and that while you stick, you know, to the truth of your own memories, you also acknowledge that others may have differing memories of the same events. And I just really appreciated that before the book. Why did you want the reader to lead with that context at front of mind?
Well, I'm really interested in memory too, and I'm interested in mining my own memories. And sometimes I don't trust my own memory, and I look for physical evidence of things. So there's an essay in here, a really difficult essay called Breaking the Codes, that's about a friend of mine was gang raped at a party, and I had invited all of the older boys over, and so I felt responsible for it. And it came to me, the essay came to me actually during the Supreme Court justice nomination of Kavanaugh, because I think a lot of us were triggered by that. And I wanted to make sure I got it right. It's such an important subject that so many of us have lived through. And so I looked for physical evidence. I looked for letters that, you know, I had passed to my, you know, had gotten, you know, instead of texts, right? We all used to pass letters in school between classes and things like that. And I found a box, talking about being a hoarder. My mother kept everything. And I'm glad that she did, because it's helped me in my writing of memoir, certainly. And I found these letters, and then I, you know, contacted some people that, you know, were involved in it and asked for their account and things like that. And it's almost like I need to find physical evidence of my own memory in order to trust it, even though I have a really, really good memory. But I also want this sort of, you know, it out in the world that, like, I may have gotten some things wrong, or I may have gotten it right, but somebody else was there and remember it completely differently. You know, and anyone who has siblings, right, talk about the same family story and there'll be four different versions. And I think that we all have our own versions and we all remember certain points or certain parts of it because those are the parts that were emotionally resonant for us, whereas the parts that were emotionally resonant for somebody else might be different.
Yeah, that is so true. Suzanne Roberts is a writer and professor based in South Lake Tahoe, discussing her recent book, Animal Bodies, on death, desire, and other difficulties. Thank you so much for spending time with us this morning, Suzanne.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about all of our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producer Nick Dobis with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.